and was completely wired for secret filming and recording. There was even a hidden camera in the TV set. The place, said Good, was furnished. Good expected that Weinberg would flip at the chance to add the exclusive four-bedroom townhouse to the Abscam illusion. He'd been enthusiastic about the plane, the cars, the left-hand, the stepped-up hotel suites, and the recent condo that the Bureau had sublet for Abscam in Ventnor, New Jersey, next door to Atlantic City. But Weinberg shrugged noncommittally and said, "Let me take a look at it." The brick house, built in Williamsburg colonial style, was a swindler's dream. It had the aura of old money, conservative, tasteful, solid. The furnishings reflected exquisite taste, oriental rugs, authentic antiques, delicate translucent china. There was even a completely stocked wine cellar, offering the best of the French and California vintages. Hidden cameras were everywhere, all of them controlled from a huge electronic panel in a locked basement room. The townhouse, Weinberg was told, was being used to entertain clients of a construction firm, set up by the Bureau to uncover bid rigging in the Washington area. The firm was named Olympic Construction Company, and was actually involved in the building business. The president of Olympic was Richard Muffoletto, a contractor from Locust Valley, Long Island. Though impressed, Weinberg still felt uneasy. Both Abscam and the Washington Sting could operate out of the townhouse, Good suggested. Different sets of agents could move in and out as needed. There might be, for example, an Abscam meeting in the townhouse on a Thursday, and a Washington Sting meeting on a Saturday. Besides, said Good, Abscam could push Olympic Construction with the mayors of the New Jersey cities. A construction contract was far more liable to illicit kickback demands than a check-cashing license. From other sources, Weinberg discovered that the Washington Sting had been operating since 1978 and was regarded as an expensive flop. The Bureau had invested $6 million in setting up Muffoletto and Olympic, which he was going to keep as his own company, paying the government back gradually out of profits. Meanwhile, Muffoletto was being paid $7,000 a month as company president, more than twice Weinberg's Abscam salary. The actual targets of the Sting were the members and staff of Congress's District of Columbia Committee and Washington City officials. The Sting had gotten such poor results, Weinberg learned, that the Bureau worried over how to justify the money it had laid out. Weinberg reported back to Good. It would be dangerous for Abscam to push Olympic with the politicians, he said, because Muffoletto was a known informer. The Bureau, he added, wasn't doing Abscam any favors offering the townhouse for meetings. Abscam was a winner, he said, and the Washington Sting was a loser. By moving Abscam into the townhouse, the Bureau was covering some of the financial losses on its other sting by charging off the townhouse to Abscam. There was some merit to Weinberg's argument. His motives, however, were more complex. He was seething at the fact that he was being paid so much less by the FBI than Muffoletto. And Muffoletto would wind up owning the construction company. All of this money to Muffoletto, while Weinberg had been using his own furniture, paying for his own tapes, flopping in cheap motels, and scrounging money for the Florida boat party. It was, he steamed, unfair. But Good turned flinty when Weinberg knocked the Washington Sting and questioned the Bureau's motives. "We'll use the townhouse, and I don't want to hear any more argument," he snapped. Weinberg shrugged, picked up the phone, and called the mayor. The meeting with the Deputy Immigration Commissioner, Talmadge, and Congressman Fowler would be at a Washington townhouse that the Arabs had just bought. Arachetti seemed impressed. Weinberg laid it on. The meeting arrangements were set. Then Weinberg got a call from Howard Crichton. Arachetti was on the phone a few minutes later with the same message. The Atlanta lawyer, who had arranged for Talmadge and Fowler to take the bribes, had just called with an urgent bulletin. Talmadge and Fowler were canceling out. The lawyer reported that Talmadge felt the timing wasn't right in view of his recent Senate censure. Fowler, the lawyer alibied, had a death in the family. No mention was made of Levitas, the third Georgia congressman promised earlier by Arachetti. Talmadge and the two congressmen have since denied knowledge of the proposed meetings. All three were first named on the Abscam tapes early in August 1979. They are mentioned several times on the tapes through August and early September, either by name, position, or both. U.S. Attorney General Griffin Bell left office on August 16, 1979, and was succeeded by his assistant Benjamin R. Civiletti. In 1980, Bell served as a manager of Senator Talmadge's unsuccessful re-election campaign. Both Criden and Arricchetti agreed, however, that the mayor would still bring Deputy Commissioner Noto to the townhouse. Arricchetti had been promising Noto for a month. He had said that he didn't know him personally, but that a mutual friend had vouched for Noto, promising that he would take the $50,000 bribe and guarantee Yasser would be issued the necessary immigration permits to remain in the United States. The mayor omitted only one important detail from his report on the proposed bribery. It was a scheme that he had hatched with Criden to swindle Abdul out of $50,000. The mayor arrived at the townhouse with a man whom he introduced as Commissioner Noto on September 19, 1979. Weinberg met them at the door and escorted them into the study. The Marx brothers would have burned with envy at the ensuing scene as recorded on videotape. Amoroso, his cigar clenched at a jaunty angle, was waiting for them. Weinberg steered the guests into seats facing the camera hidden in the TV, and unobtrusively placed the attaché case containing the $50,000 bribe on the floor, near the supposed immigration official. Casually, he glanced at Amoroso, shaking his head slightly. Amoroso nodded. The man brought in by Criden and Arricchetti was definitely not Deputy Immigration Commissioner Mario Noto. They had screened pictures of the real Noto. "Do you have a card, Commissioner?" asked Amoroso. The ersatz commissioner, later identified as Robert Cook, one of Criden's law partners, replied that he rarely left his office and had no reason to carry business cards. Amoroso looked at Arricchetti. Then he rose and walked toward another room, calling, "Mayor, let me see you outside a minute." Arricchetti followed Amoroso out, and the door closed behind him. Weinberg made small talk for a few minutes with Cook, and then said, "I didn't get your name."
"Nopo," fumbled Cook. "N-O-P-O."
"We understand that Mr. Nopo is a much older man," said Weinberg gently. "We're afraid that someone might be throwing in a ringer. We have to be careful." Cook nervously replied, "If it's a bust today, it's a bust." Weinberg told him not to worry and left the room. Scene. Cook sits alone in a chair. He stares unknowingly at the hidden camera. He is motionless, a frozen man. Slowly, 3 minutes and 26 seconds pass by. The only sounds are in the background. A plane flies over, birds chirp, a church bell tolls, the clock ticks. Cook seems scarcely to breathe. An FBI agent enters the room and gazes around. His eyes lock on the attaché case with the money sitting at Cook's feet. "Is this yours?" the agent asks as he picks it up.
"No, of course not," croaks Cook, swallowing hard.
The agent carries the case out of the room. More background noise. Cook remains in the chair, unmoving, unblinking, etched in time and place. In the adjoining room, Amoroso carefully picked his words as he talked to the mayor. Arricchetti was Abscam's most important middleman. Amoroso shrewdly realized that he might lose Arricchetti forever if he accused him of trying to put over a ringer. The volatile mayor would save face by turning on his accuser. He would leave in a rage, taking all of his contacts with him. Amoroso quickly backtracked his memory. The mayor had told them he didn't know Noto personally. He said that the immigration official had been obtained through a mutual friend. Amoroso decided to use the mayor's phony story for leverage. He asked him what he knew about the friend who had arranged the meeting. Arricchetti, sensing something amiss, said he only knew the friend casually. His answer gave Amoroso the opening he had needed. Amoroso whispered to the mayor that the man sitting in the other room was an imposter. He said that he was worried both for the mayor and for his own group. Maybe, he speculated, The imposter was an FBI agent sent to trap them. And maybe the mayor's casual friend was also part of the FBI plot. Arricchetti exhaled slowly. Then he bit. The mayor was a good actor. His face turned scarlet, and his eyes bulged with righteous indignation.
"I've been jackpotted," he hissed.
The mayor quickly agreed to Amoroso's suggested counterplot. Arricchetti would tell the imposter that there had been a mistake about the purpose of the meeting. He would stay super cool. He would drop the imposter off at the government building where he had originally picked him up. Later, when the mayor returned from a scheduled Florida trip with Weinberg, he would cautiously check to learn whether the whole thing had been an FBI sting. Arricchetti left with Cook. He had taken the face-saving way out. He traveled to Florida the next day and attended several taped meetings there with Weinberg and Amoroso. After that, they would not see him again. Weinberg is sure that the mayor knew he had been compromised and was too embarrassed to face them. Over the phone, he correctly accused Weinberg of dealing with rival New Jersey politicians, complained that none of the promised deals had ever materialized, and raged that his integrity had been challenged as a result of the Ringer deal. Weinberg worked desperately to win back the mayor. The Abscam Group even transferred $1 million into an Atlantic City bank that Arricchetti had been touting for months. The mayor had claimed that Stephen Persky, the state senator who fathered casino gambling in New Jersey, had an interest in the bank. But the mayor had turned his back on Yasser and Abscam for good. Scene. Weinberg and Arricchetti are sitting on a plane headed for Florida. The mayor is unusually quiet. He is, in fact, sulking. His scheme to steal a fast $50,000 with a noto ringer has been blown. Weinberg tells a few surefire dirty jokes. The mayor doesn't laugh. He doesn't even smile. Weinberg spots a pretty black hostess coming down the aisle. He decides on a play to the mayor's economy-sized ego. Weinberg loudly tells the stewardess that the man sitting next to him is the mayor of Camden, New Jersey, and a state senator. "Really?" she asks. Weinberg introduces her to the mayor, who instantly brightens. Arricchetti boasts of his power and influence. The stewardess interrupts the mayor in mid-paragraph. "Who gives a shit?" she whispers sweetly and moves away. The mayor looks like he's been smashed with a brick. "Those damn niggers are all alike," he mutters. He slouches back into his sulk. Weinberg gives up. Scene. Amoroso, trailed by Weinberg, walks importantly into Atlantic City's Boardwalk Bank. He is about to open an account with the bank for $1 million. The money has secretly been transferred from FBI operating funds. Mayor Arricchetti has been advised and has indicated through his secretary that Amoroso will get a fitting reception from the bank officers. Amoroso clears his throat noisily, and a young lady looks up from her desk. Amoroso gives his name and says he is there to meet a high bank official. The young lady replies that the official is tied up. She asks if she can help. "I want to open an account with $1 million, Amoroso states imperiously. "Fill these out, please," says the young lady, handing him a batch of routine application forms. Amoroso looks at Weinberg. Weinberg looks at Amoroso and lifts an eyebrow. Both shrug. Amoroso fills out the forms as the young lady busies herself with other work. He finishes and hands the forms to the young lady. "Thank you," she says, and hands Amoroso his temporary checkbook. They leave the bank. Weinberg calls the mayor. The mayor is out. Arricchetti was replaced as Abscam's key middleman by Howard Crichton. Weinberg is convinced that both Arricchetti and Crichton designed it that way. From the first, as Crichton later admitted, it had been he who had been reaching the various congressmen to take bribes. He continued to do so. But he would later add another dimension to the investigation. Direct contact with a key representative of the National Gambling Syndicate. Precise, intelligent, low-key. Crichton fitted the classic stereotype of the influence peddler far more exactly than talkative, impetuous Mayor Arricchetti. It is axiomatic in the business of selling politicians that known middlemen are watched middlemen. Although he had been an assistant district attorney in Philadelphia, and later an assistant state attorney general, Criden was unknown to the usually astute Philadelphia press corps. He was, however, an integral part of the corrupt Philadelphia Democratic machine, and used the organization's political clout to forge relationships with the vast network of similar influence peddlers in virtually every city and state in the nation. Known in the gray world of political corruption as bagmen, people like Criden provide the same type of insulation for crooked politicians that Arricchetti was supposed to give to Kenneth MacDonald of the New Jersey Casino Control Commission, and lawyer Alex Feinberg to Senator Harrison Williams. Most of them are lawyers, buying and selling public and party officials under the cover of apparently legitimate legal representation or lobbying activities. If a lawyer in Philadelphia, for example, wants to buy a congressman from Georgia, he calls his counterpart middleman in Atlanta, and the deed is set in motion. Like most middlemen, Criden had survived and prospered by being careful. He preferred not to talk on the telephone, always suspecting a law enforcement tap. But he often broke his own rules. A former Army intelligence officer, Criden frequently implied that he had current CIA ties. Weinberg found himself constantly fending off Criden's questions about Abdul, Yasser, and the entire Abscam cover story. Criden and Weinberg are in deep conversation. The heavyset lawyer is persistent. He wants to know exactly where Yasser comes from. Weinberg is evasive. Any country he names can be immediately checked by Criden. Criden. What country? Weinberg. Who the fuck knows? Criden. But I want to know what country he's from. Weinberg. One of them, what they call emigrant. Criden. Arab emigrants? Weinberg. Yeah. Criden. Emirates? Weinberg. Emirates, yeah, one of them. Criden also questioned Amoroso's cover as a former CIA agent. He said that CIA agents recognized one another through a system of conversational buzzwords and recognition signals. Weinberg stalled a moment while he thought it over. If Criden actually was connected with the CIA, he would know Amoroso was fake, and the whole scam would be endangered. He had spent months selling Amoroso's CIA cover to Abscam's targets. He had even countered the mayor's complaints about Ernie Haridopoulos, with the invention that Ernie had once been on a CIA assassination squad and still had bad dreams about all the people he had killed. Still, Criden could be lying. It was possible that he was merely testing the Abscam cover. Weinberg played both ends against the middle. He told Criden that he had only known Amoroso for a year. He said that he believed that Amoroso had been in the CIA, but it was possible that he had not been. Maybe, he said, Amoroso had fabricated his CIA background to get his job with Yasser. He said that he really didn't care if Amoroso had lied to Yasser. In the year that he had worked with him, Weinberg said, Amoroso had proved to be smart, safe, and a compatible crook. Ironically, the Cook fiasco with the mayor may have been the clincher for Criden. Since Criden had secretly teamed with Arricchetti to cheat Abscam with a ringer, he knew that Cook, his law partner, wasn't part of any FBI trap. But the very fact that Amoroso had voiced that fear to Arricchetti may have convinced Criden that Abscam was for real. Anyone suspicious of an FBI trap had a head start in credibility. Once convinced, Criden literally gushed the names of congressmen he said he was approaching to come in and take bribes from the Abscam agents. From bits and pieces of his taped conversations, it was apparent he was arranging for these congressmen through other middlemen. Some of the prospects named by Criden included House Majority Leader James Wright of Texas, House Majority Whip John Brademas of Indiana, Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey, Congressman James Howard of New Jersey, and Congressman Jim Maddox of Texas. The names sent a shockwave through the FBI and the Department of Justice. Wright and Brademas, who had also been suggested earlier by the mayor, were the two most powerful members of Congress behind House Speaker Thomas O'Neill. Senator Bradley was a respected former Rhodes Scholar and NBA star. It was also just at this time in the history of Abscam that Bill Rosenberg, the persistent Long Island swindler who earlier had been sidestepped as a middleman, chimed in with the names of two senators and a congressman. Weinberg had kept him current on the Myers and Lederer bribes as a way of keeping Abdul and Yasser's credibility alive. Rosenberg was still waiting for the money on the CDs he had given Weinberg a year before, so was still very much in touch. He called Weinberg in the fall of 1979 and said that he had access to several people in Congress who would assure asylum for Yasser. He said they were Senators Jacob Javits and Daniel Moynihan and Congressman Norman Lent, all of New York. He called back a short time later, scratching Moynihan from the list. "He was very cold," complained Rosenberg. However, he said, he was sure that Javits and Lent would help. "Can we meet him and say, 'Here's $50,000, take it and run?'" Weinberg asked. "Oh, no," replied a shocked Rosenberg. He suggested that Abscam contribute $100,000 to the GOP Congressional Committee through its executive director, Stephen Stockmeyer. The money would be a campaign contribution. The GOP candidates, if elected, would help Yasser. Weinberg told Rosenberg to forget it. To himself, he added, campaign contributions weren't crimes. The names of Wright and Brademus are not mentioned again on the tapes. Weinberg shrugs and explains, "Nobody in government told me to push it." He was referring to the basic Abscam routine. If a name was mentioned on tape as a potential bribe target, Weinberg was usually told to explore the bribe possibility further in conversations with the middleman. Approval for the actual bribe meeting also had to come from Washington. Nor did Howard Crichton push it. It's quite possible that his contacts told him that the two House leaders could not be bought. It's also possible that he was merely throwing their names into the hat to impress his newfound associates. Weinberg did ask him about Bradley at a later date, and Crichton replied that he couldn't be gotten. Crichton was also complaining at this time that many of the congressmen he reached were wary about coming to the townhouse for their money. "There was no problem getting bribeable congressmen," said Crichton, adding, "I can get you almost anyone you want." But he complained that the congressmen were a wary breed. "In the first place, when you lay the Abscam story on the guy, he don't believe it," said Crichton, "because right away he thinks he's being..." inaudible. "Someone trying to middle or something like that. The congressman's got to do it with a middleman he trusts implicitly. Otherwise, he ain't gonna do it, okay?" Another time, Crichton complained, "There are some problems on our side. Okay, I understand that you needed a candidate, Congressman. Okay. But you know, let me tell you, to convince those guys to do this number is not as easy as you think it is. They are so... drive me bananas. You don't have to deal with these guys like I do. They drive me fucking bananas with their intrigue. They're in the middle of the goddamned... they make a commitment to you. They get chicken feet, and they say they don't want to do it. Or they want to do it this way, or they want to do it that way, or they don't want to do it at all. Okay, I go nuts." The middleman's tirade came shortly after arrangements had collapsed for a meeting at the townhouse with Congressman Howard of New Jersey. Crichton called saying that Howard had switched signals. He said that Howard would meet only in the safety of his own congressional office. Crichton explained that the congressman was skittish about security at the townhouse. Howard's name was scratched from the Abscam target list. Some congressmen, however, were apparently willing to take the risk. After several weeks of negotiations, Crichton made an appointment for two of them to come to the townhouse on October 9, 1979. They were Frank Thompson of New Jersey, chairman of the powerful House Administration Committee, and Jim Maddox of Texas. Amoroso once again reviewed the bribe conditions with Crichton. The congressmen must agree to use their offices for Yasser and accept the bribe money directly. Crichton agreed. A schedule was set. Crichton would hire a limousine and drive from Philadelphia to the Capitol, where he would pick up Thompson and return him after the meeting. Then at the end of the day's congressional session, he would return to the Capitol, pick up Maddox, and bring him to the townhouse. Crichton said that both Thompson and Maddox had been fully briefed. About Maddox, he said,
Don't worry about Jim. He's 1,000%. He added that Maddox wanted to come in the evening, so that the meeting would not show in the daily schedule that his secretary logged. On the appointed day, the Abscam team sat playing poker in the townhouse, waiting for Thompson and Criden to arrive. Thompson, the fourth or fifth-ranking House Democrat, was heady game. There was an air of excitement. Good was there with Jacobs from the strike force. Weir had come down from Del Tufo's office in New Jersey to observe. Haridopoulos was there, and Brady and Bursey, and the FBI electronics technician. "Nobody wanted to leave," recalls Weinberg. It was a convention, which Good set about to disperse. Only those absolutely necessary to the scam could remain. Haridopoulos and Brady were to leave as Thompson entered. Bursey would stay to serve drinks and be on call. Good took Jacobs and Weir in tow and went down to the locked control room with the electronic specialist. They would monitor the meeting by TV from there. Weinberg and Amoroso sat expectantly at the round table in the study. As usual at such meetings, they were dressed casually. Weinberg wore a sports shirt, slacks, and no socks. Amoroso was similarly dressed, but he wore socks. It was part of the sting atmosphere orchestrated by Weinberg. Formality, even business suits, put people on their guard, he had explained to Good. Everything, even the offer of the bribe, had to be done casually. As Weinberg explained it, "Like we couldn't have cared less. Like, hey, you want to take the money, you don't want to take the money, fuck it." Thompson and Criden arrived. The congressman admired the house and asked for a tour. Weinberg led the way, carefully avoiding the locked control room. The congressman, boasting of his wine expertise, browsed through the wine cellar and pronounced it quite acceptable. The ice broken, they gathered around the table. Thompson began by describing his enormous power as chairman of the administration committee. The subject then swung to the Arabs' plight. "We represent Yasser Habib and Kambir Abdul Rahman," explained Weinberg. "The problem is what happened to Somoza and the Shah of Iran, that God forbid if anything happens over there, and they want to come to this country. They want to be sponsored. And they want us to meet people that will sponsor them. And Howard Criden said you could do something for us." Amoroso embroidered the details and asked Thompson if he would introduce a bill to give the Arabs refuge in the United States. Thompson said that he would, but he warned that a bill was not a sure guarantee of success. Amoroso replied, "Well, that's what the money's for." Thompson's answer was a shock. "I'm not looking for any money, and it depends on the circumstances," he stammered. "I mean, not a communist, and not a known criminal." He asked the origin of the two Arabs. Criden quickly volunteered, "One of the Emirates." Weinberg took a stab. "You see, Abdul married one of the king's or sheikh's daughters, and he became an emir, all right? And they realize over there eventually the guerrillas are going to take over. The Palestine guerrillas are, well, it's just a matter of time, and they want security. They're putting millions and millions of dollars into this country, all right? And they just want to know that they have the right people behind them when the time comes." The congressman said that he would welcome investment of the Arabs' money in his district and suggested several businesses owned by his friends and law partners. He again promised to introduce a bill for Abdul and Yasser. Amoroso wanted to reoffer the payment to Thompson, but stopped when Criden kicked him under the table. He thanked Thompson, and as Weinberg listened slack-jawed, suggested that Criden drive the congressman back to the Capitol. No bribe had been passed. As soon as the door closed behind the departing congressman, Weinberg asked Amoroso why he hadn't just given Thompson the money. "Only if he spells out why he's taking it," said Amoroso. "Don't worry. He'll be back." Criden rushed back to the townhouse in near apoplexy. Why hadn't Amoroso given the money to him? He would have privately given it to Thompson. Those were the arrangements that Thompson had made with him. Thompson didn't want to take the money directly from Amoroso. The lawyer was so frustrated that at one point tears streamed from beneath his horn-rimmed glasses.
He said that Weinberg had told him that the indirect payment was acceptable. Weinberg pleaded a misunderstanding. At one point, Crichton begged Amoroso to drop his insistence on direct payment. He said, "I made a commitment to the man, Thompson, and the man delivered. Okay? His end of the bargain. And then you tell him he didn't do something right. He ain't gonna buy it. This guy's been around too long for that." Amoroso wouldn't budge. Crichton tried again. "Listen," he said, "this cocksucker needs money worse than anybody in this fucking room." Amoroso shrugged and suggested if Thompson needed money that badly, "let him get into the fucking water with us." Nearly an hour passed in argument. Amoroso agreed to pass the bribe money to Crichton only if Thompson witnessed the event and agreed that the money was being paid to him for his official acts. Crichton sighed deeply and accepted the crumb. He left for a talk with Thompson at the Capitol. Tape 14. Weinberg. After Crichton left, we was discussing it. John Good said Tony done the right thing. Jacobs got all excited and said, "I don't think he's coming back." Tony says he'll be back. I really didn't know. I was greatly upset. I actually thought we blew it because we pushed Crichton to a point of no return, as they say. I just didn't think we was going to make it. But then, like I say, I take my hat off to Tony again. He pushed him, Crichton, to a point. And you got to remember, Tony was under great pressure. If he paid the guy, and the guy didn't say anything, everybody in the place would have said he shouldn't have paid him. The pressure on Tony was incredible. You know, my pressure was bad, but not that bad. I didn't have to make any decisions about payment. Tony had to make the decisions. Tony worked for the FBI. And if he made a bad decision, it was his ass. Me? I couldn't give a shit less. Crichton returned later with Thompson. "Okay, Frank understands the situation now," said Crichton. "You know and you know," Amoroso replied, holding out the money-filled briefcase to the two men. "I just want to make sure you know that you understand. There's the briefcase." Thompson turned to Crichton. "You look after that for me, will you?" he asked. Crichton took the briefcase. "Well, as long as I know now," Amoroso added. "Okay, I think he," Crichton, "explained it to you." Thompson held up his eyeglasses. "I got these, all right?" "Fine," he replied. It was done. The chairman of the House Administration Committee was in the bag. It was late. Crichton dialed Congressman Maddox's office and canceled out. They parted with Thompson's promise to bring in more congressmen, particularly a good friend of his from New York. He did, and the parade continued. Tape 15. Weinberg. "Me and Tony made a great team. We were meant for each other. He was an easygoing, cool-headed guy, and he learned fast. At the beginning, he didn't talk as much as I did, and in the end, he was doing more talking. The guy learned fast. He was a quick picker-upper. He just knew how to handle things. If I got into a spot, he would jump in. If he got in a spot, I would jump in. We even had a system to keep each other from dozing off during some of them long, boring sessions. The team was good. The guys FBI around us was good. Steve, Ernie, Bruce. We was all good together." 11. Messing with the mob. It helps to know the wise guys, but don't go into business with them. You'll wind up either screwed or dead. Mel Weinberg. He slept fitfully on the king-size bed. The dreams were bad. They had no beginning, no end. Faster and faster they flickered from scene to scene. All had the same theme. He was being murdered. Somehow he had crossed the wise guys. "No hard feelings," they said. "Nothing personal. Boom, you're dead." He moaned and slammed a fist into his twisted pillow. The executioner was always a polite goy in a Brooks Brothers suit, but inventive. Already the bastard had strangled him with piano wire,
punched an ice pick into his brain, buggered him with a cattle prod, and mashed him in a compactor. Weinberg came awake, shouting. He shook his head. Ah! More of those damn dreams. The morning sunlight shafted through the windows. He sat up in bed and shook his head again. Got to get oriented. Check it off. Morning, September 20th, 1979. Holiday Inn, Hallandale, Florida. He had flown in the night before with Mayor Arricchetti. Lousy trip. The mayor was annoyed, probably because he hadn't ripped them off the day before with his phony immigration official. Nice try, though. Click. They were here to meet with Alvin Malnick, the apparent heir to mob financial wizard Meyer Lansky. Okay. That explained the dreams. He didn't mind scamming politicians. The only weapons they had, he thought, were wise-ass lawyers. But the mob was different. No sense of humor. Just a dead fish on your doorstep. A red snapper, maybe, to let the family know that you're not coming back and the local undertaker is going to get stiffed because you're under 18 inches of concrete and a permanent part of the new interstate highway system. He shuddered at the thought. He'd always stayed on the right side of the wise guys. When he bellied up to the bar at Orlando's with Tony Ducks Corallo and Neil Migliore, he always bought. When Jimmy Knapp called for a favor, he always did it. And once or twice when he needed something small like vouching, they'd help him out. But he always showed respect. Hadn't he walked away from the gambling casino in St. Martin when Meyer Lansky called him and told him to bug off? Now John Good wanted him to take on Lansky's number one man. At least, that's what the Bureau said. The fact that he was a government crook wasn't going to help him with the mob. Sure, Amoroso would be with him. And Good and the rest of the team were in rooms downstairs, ready to back him up if there was trouble. But that wasn't going to help 5 years from now, when the government had sucked him dry and tossed him away like it did all of its informants. The mob had a long memory, and Meyer Lansky was something special. Why the hell was he doing this? It sure wasn't for the money, although he couldn't complain lately. Good had gotten him a $15,000 bonus last spring after Mayor Arricchetti and Kenneth MacDonald had taken the bribes. The Bureau had given him another $10,000 in relocation expenses. And Good said that when the entire investigation was over, he would push to get him a lump sum bonus for his work. But nobody could pay him enough to do this. He was doing it because John Good had asked him to do it. He shrugged. That was enough. As far as the Bureau was concerned, Alvin Malnick was the key to Lansky, the wispy, seamed old man who lived in a modest Miami apartment, walked his dog every night along Collins Avenue, and was the mob's expert on bookmaking, gambling casinos, and washing dirty money. And Lansky, Weinberg reflected, still ran Las Vegas and collected the skim for the real owners of the multi-million-dollar casinos that lined the fabulous strip. The list read like a who's who of the American underworld. Good wanted some answers. What, if anything, did Malnick have to do with the Aladdin Hotel in Las Vegas? How strong were his ties with Caesar's Palace, another of the huge strip casinos? Was he connected with Resorts International or the Boardwalk Regency, the two Atlantic City casinos that had already opened? Would he be involved in some of the others? How did the Lansky-Malnick relationship work? And, Good added, get it all on tape. The same theme had dominated Weinberg's recent talks with Amoroso. The mob, Vegas, Atlantic City, Meyer, gambling. The swindler and the FBI crime expert swapping notes. Both knew a lot. Weinberg's love of gambling had lured him to Vegas more times than he could remember. Friendly wise guys would always call ahead to make sure that he got the best of everything. He went big at the crap tables and bought big for his wise guy hosts. He was a good listener. For his part, Amoroso's information had come from informants and hundreds of FBI bugs and telephone taps. Weinberg sat on the edge of the bed, feet braced on the floor, and thought about getting dressed. He quickly rejected the idea. Diane was driving down to meet him and would be here in an hour. He'd take a quick shower. He climbed out of the shower and spent 15 minutes carefully cleaning his nails. He hated people with dirty nails. The sight of them, for some particular reason, made him feel sick. He rubbed dry, plodded back to the bed, and lay down on his back, hands clasped on the pillow behind his head. It was a good time to think things out. He pondered the mob. Mostly Italian. Families running the rackets in most of the country's major cities. Five families running New York and New Jersey. A real mess. Most other places had only one. It was just like the Godfather. A boss at the head of each family. Each boss had his capos. Underneath were the soldiers. If you were invited into a family, you were a man of respect. But the old Jewish mob wasn't dead yet. At least Meyer Lansky wasn't. Everybody in the mob needed Meyer. The wop hoods could talk gambling until they croaked, but they didn't know shit about it. Most of them couldn't even count good. They depended on Meyer and his boys to handle the credit, set the odds, run the casinos, deal the cards. Only Meyer could give you a casino crew that wouldn't rip you off, boys who knew how to make money. And it was Meyer who could get your money in and out. Wise guys couldn't get licensed in Nevada. So if you wanted a piece of a casino, you had to own it in secret. Each casino was broken down into 100 secret ownership points. The cost of a point in one of the bigger operations, like Caesar's Palace, could be $100,000 and up. Your name didn't appear anywhere as an owner. They had stiffs fronting the license. But if you owned a point, you were an owner. Mo Dalitz, Meyer's man in Vegas, kept track of everybody's secret points. The points were bought and sold between the wise guys, and Dalitz kept track of everything. Nobody cheated. That's why Vegas ticked. There were lots of ways for points to make money in Vegas. The points themselves were like shares on the stock market. They were shares in the skim. Las Vegas, except for the high rollers on credit, is a cash business. Lots of cash. A certain amount of that cash each night never got to the counting windows and wasn't recorded on the books. This was skim. Then there were the vendors, suppliers of liquor, food, laundry, you name it, who gave cash kickbacks. That was skim. Each week, the skim would be divided by 100 points. Each point owner would get his share of the cash. The money would be picked up by couriers and deposited in Swiss bank accounts or flushed through a series of corporate fronts and offshore banks operated by Lansky. Since the skim money was cash, and Uncle didn't know about it, it was tax-free. Nothing changed when the big gambling corporations like Caesar's World and some of the others went public. The wise guys simply had banks, corporations, and other nominees hold their stock. And they still got their points of the skim. Legitimate profits from the casinos were so huge that the average sucker who bought his stock through a brokerage house never realized that he should be making even more. The difference was the amount skimmed off each week by his unknown silent partners. The Italian mob, the Cosa Nostra, needed Meyer very badly, and Meyer needed the mob. A good marriage. Both Las Vegas and Miami were known as open cities. No family owned them. Everyone could suck at the teat as long as they had the money and went by Meyer's rules. Now casino gambling was coming to New Jersey. The mob had declared Atlantic City an open city. Meyer's boys, as usual, would provide the know-how. But Angelo Bruno, boss of the Philadelphia family, didn't want to play by the rules. He wanted most of the city for his family. The other wise guys were pissed. Bruno was a dead man. He just didn't know it yet. Meyer was getting old. He was nearly 80. Too old to take jail time. Each year he added another layer of insulation. His old buddy and closest friend Sam Cohen was getting old too. That was the reason for Alvin Malnick, a clever lawyer in his late 40s, who knew how to grease and when. He also knew how to count. Meyer still called the big shots, but Alvin was being groomed. He'd wheeled and dealed the Teamster Pension Fund for so many loans that Jimmy Hoffa was cross-eyed when they stuffed him in a barrel. Good's interest in the mob in Atlantic City had ballooned the day Mayor Ericchetti ambled through Abdul's door. And it hadn't let up since. If anything, it increased when Senator Williams's partner, George Katz, came into the picture. Katz knew Lansky. and he was an asshole buddy of Sam Cohen, Lansky's top lieutenant. Good had pushed both Weinberg and Amoroso to get everything they could on the mob from Katz and the mayor. They hadn't done too badly, either. The mayor was the first to bite. He said that he had his own connection with the mob. According to Arricchetti, his man in the Cosa Nostra was Paul Castellano, the new boss of the old Carlo Gambino crime family in New York. Early in the game, when Weinberg and Amoroso had pushed the mayor for assurances that Abdul's casino wouldn't be bothered by the mob, Arricchetti told them that he had Castellano's personal blessing. Another powerful mobster in Atlantic City, the mayor had said, was Jerry Catena, semi-retired boss of the old Genovese crime family. Arricchetti said several times that Catena owned Joseph Lordi, chairman of the State Casino Control Commission. The mayor was echoed by Tony Torcasio, the veteran gambler from Las Vegas who had been hired to run Guccione's proposed penthouse casino in Atlantic City. Both Arricchetti and Torcasio had said that Jerry Catena spent most of his time in Florida, but still represented his crime family's casino interests in Atlantic City through his control of Joseph Lordi, who was also the former district attorney of Essex, Newark County. Catena was a regular at the Boca Raton Hotel in Florida, owned by the contractor who was supposed to be building the penthouse for Guccione. The contractor himself had come to Abdul and guaranteed a casino license if Abdul wanted to cut Guccione out and finance the casino itself. Standard mix of wise guys and politicians, Weinberg thought. The ankle bones connected to the leg bone, and so on. A huge circle jerk. This guy knows that guy who's connected to this guy. In almost any other walk of life, it didn't mean anything. But in this game, it meant everything. Because these guys didn't bother knowing each other unless they could make money together. Social friendships were for golfers and Rotarians. The mayor had described his meeting with Castellano. Phone calls from public booths, switched cars, a pat-down at the gate from Castellano's bodyguards. The mayor, who delighted at playing hood, had offered to bring Amoroso on his next visit to the mob boss. From Arricchetti's description of Castellano's security drill, Amoroso knew he might have to go in without cover and a tape recorder. Too big a chance of being compromised. He shrugged off the invitation, and Arricchetti forgot about it. Scene. Weinberg is eating breakfast at a hotel in Mount Laurel, New Jersey, with Mayor Arricchetti. Lurking someplace near is Agent Steve Bercy, Weinberg's cover for the day. There's no tape of the meeting. Weinberg has forgotten to bring down the attaché case with the tape recorder inside. He's too tired to go back and get it. Fuck it. The conversation is dull anyhow. Arricchetti on Arricchetti. The mayor stops in mid-sentence and leaps from the table. He brings over a man who has just entered the dining room. "Mel," beams the mayor. "I want you to meet my good friend Joe Gambino." Weinberg gulps. The name is Gambino. And the man shaking his hand has the smell of a wise guy. There's some quick chit-chat. Gambino is escorted to another table. As soon as he sits, two men arrive and sit down with him. He's holding court. He's a wise guy. The mayor confirms it. Joe runs a lot of things around here. He reaches into Atlantic City, too. The mayor says that Gambino will give them an audience in a half hour. Arricchetti is glowing. Weinberg looks frantically for Bercy. He knows he's in the background, but he can't see him. Besides, he doesn't have his tape recorder. Weinberg slowly releases a stream of cigar smoke at the mayor. "Screw Joe Gambino," he says. "He's shit. He's nothing." The mayor is shocked. He protests Gambino is important. Weinberg, rising from his chair, tosses a contemptuous look in Gambino's direction and whispers to the mayor, "If he's so fucking important, how come he don't clean his fingernails?" As they leave the dining room, the mayor is scratching his head. His look says he isn't sure whether he's heard Weinberg correctly. It had been in early August, while they waited at Kennedy Airport to give Senator Williams his titanium stock, that the mayor had first mentioned Meyer Lansky. It was the same day that Arricchetti confirmed the arrangements for the bribery of Congressman Myers and Lederer,
so it had slipped by in the conversation. But the mayor had returned to the subject more often as the days passed. His interest, undoubtedly, was stimulated by his budding friendship with Howard Crichton. The mayor met frequently with Weinberg and Amoroso that August. He bubbled with plans to perfect the titanium deal with Senator Williams and the payoffs to the two congressmen, Myers and Lederer. George Katz was present at a few of these meetings. The Boardwalk Regency, a sibling of Caesar's Palace, had opened in Atlantic City with a temporary license. There were newspaper stories reporting that the casino might have problems getting its permanent license because of past business connections between Alvin Malnick and Caesar's board chairman Cliff Perlman. Both Arricchetti and Katz confided that Perlman still had close ties with Lansky and Malnick. Now that Abdul was preparing to build an Atlantic City gambling casino, what Abdul needed, Weinberg insisted, was a connection with Maya Lansky. Without such a protector, he argued, other mobsters would muscle into Abdul's proposed casino operations. Besides, he added, only Lansky could provide the gambling experts needed for the casino. Arricchetti had considered the problem. He said that he didn't know Lansky, but was close to someone who knew him well. This guy Lansky is going to be very fucking careful, Arricchetti cautioned. He ain't been in trouble. Using one of his favorite expressions, Arricchetti said that he'd already been head-to-head with his Lansky contact. He described the contact as a guy who's pretty high up there. Then the mayor dropped a few tidbits. He reported that he had asked his contact to speak to Lansky and determine whether he would get involved in Atlantic City. There were rumors, he said, that his associate Malnick was already active in the area. The mayor had another hot item. He said that members of the Detroit Cosa Nostra family had a heavy point interest in the Aladdin Hotel in Las Vegas. Weinberg steered the conversation back to Lansky and asked the mayor to get specifics from Lansky on what he might do for Abdul's proposed gambling interests. Give us the rules, who controls what, and who's going to sit with whom, and what he, Lansky's going to ask, okay? The mayor agreed. Early in September, the mayor reported that the meeting between Lansky and his contact had been arranged. He also seemed to have more information about the mob money genius. The quickest way to Lansky, he confided, was through his stepdaughter-in-law, Susan. She was a widow of Lansky's stepson, who had been murdered in a parking area near his Miami restaurant by mob gunmen. The murder, said Arricchetti, was a matter of underworld honor. The stepson apparently had killed the son of a Cosa Nostra soldier in a drunken argument. Weinberg shuddered. The mayor, despite his fluency on the subject, was a man with second-hand knowledge. Weinberg had personal reasons for his reaction to Arricchetti's recital of the contract killing. A year before, he had been reached by Lansky's brother and asked if the Abdul operation was for real or just another one of Weinberg's scams. He had assured him that Abdul was legitimate. This contact had occurred in Miami while Weinberg was working on a CD sting for the local FBI. A Miami businessman had visited him and suggested he call Jake Lansky. Weinberg knew Jake. He treated the request like a royal command and called Jake from a public phone. Afterward, he scrawled a brief account of the conversation on a piece of paper and threw it into a box with his expense account receipts. It read in part, Jake Lansky and told me that he wanted to know Abdul. Mentioned Meyer wanted to know about it. Told me that they, Lansky Group, are trying to move them out of Atlantic City. Bruno family. We could do big things if you're for real. Problem that Abdul is for real. Lansky's brother was testing, Weinberg reasoned. If Abdul was legitimate, Meyer Lansky intended to use its money to buy up Atlantic City, shoving out Angelo Bruno of the Philadelphia family with the sheer weight of Abdul's cash. Weinberg had lied when he told Jake that Abdul wasn't a scam and stalled further discussions, pleading that he would get back to Jake when the Abdul operation was fully organized. He might have been excused for lying, he thought, if nothing further had happened and the Lansky group lost neither time nor money. Now, however, he was pushing Abdul directly at Meyer Lansky, and as a consequence, would be scamming one of the most powerful men in the American underworld. That was a mob no-no. Lansky was, he had reflected, a deadly son of a bitch. In mid-September, Eric Hetty enthusiastically reported that his contact would be sitting down with Lansky the next day. He no longer referred to the mobster as Lansky. Now it was just plain Meyer. The mayor said his contact was giving Meyer the following message on behalf of the Abdul Group. 1. They didn't want any trouble. 2. They didn't want to die. 3. They didn't want to be ripped off. And 4. They wanted to run a profitable business and not be killed financially. Mournfully, Weinberg assured the mayor that he had sent exactly the right message to Lansky. Several days later, Eric Hetty summoned Weinberg to New Jersey for a meeting with his Lansky contact, Howard Crichton. Later investigation would show that Crichton had been closely associated with the Lansky group for a number of years. He had, in fact, been a business partner of Lansky's protege, Alvin Malnick, in several Florida deals. Weinberg had a sudden thought when the mayor revealed Crichton's role. It would return frequently over the following months. Howard Crichton, who delivered the congressman, was more than a bagman. He was also Meyer Lansky's man. The mob, he reflected, had a long reach. Crichton wasted no time. He said that he had lunched with Meyer Lansky and reported that Lansky would work with Abdul. Further, he had sent Crichton to Malnick to arrange the details. Lansky, said Crichton, was already involved in Atlantic City. Crichton, there's nothing going to happen anywhere without Lansky. The two joints that are functioning in Atlantic City are his joints. Resorts is originally his, through the Mary Carter Paint Company. Cliff Pearlman, Caesar's Palace and Boardwalk Regency. Mr. Lansky owns Lock, Stock, and Barrel. He put him in business. Weinberg. Well, I know he put him in business. And I knew, bluffing, that he had a piece of Caesar's. How much he owned, I never knew. Crichton. Do you think that Cliff goes to the fucking bathroom without talking to Malnick? Weinberg later returned to the subject of Lansky's interest in Atlantic City. Weinberg, may I ask you a question? How are these other casinos that are opening here going to operate? Crichton, where in Atlantic City, I didn't ask. I didn't go into details with Malnick. I know that he... Inaudible. Desk in the penthouse was about 3 messages. One was from Crosby, Resorts. One was from Jack Davis, Resorts. And the number 3 was from... Inaudible. Okay, I know Malnick talks with Crosby every day. Now, how the rest of these things, I don't know. I know that as far as Resorts is concerned, they check with him, Malnick. I know that as far as Cliff is concerned, they're partners. Crichton produced mortgage documents for the Cricket Club in Miami, a swank condominium complex owned by Alvin Malnick and Lansky's buddy Sam Cohen. Pearlman appeared on the papers as a guarantor of mortgage loans to the club complex. Crichton said that Malnick wanted to deal. The Lansky aide proposed that Abdul buy the Aladdin Hotel in Las Vegas and the Cricket Club in Miami. Abdul could either buy both outright, or Malnick would share Abdul's interest. He would handle the management of both through frontmen. He would also provide staff and management for Abdul's planned casino in Atlantic City. Again and again, Crichton stressed that Malnick was Lansky, and he warned that nothing would happen in Atlantic City unless Lansky was part of it. The middleman became expansive as he talked about Lansky's power in Las Vegas. He boasted, "They own, inaudible, commissioner in Vegas and Nevada, inaudible. They own him lock, stock, and barrel, okay? If they tell him to shit, he squats. Now, if the Stardust Casino is inaudible, the Nevada authorities tell him they have to sell it. They were supposed to close the place down and wound up with a $100,000 fine. Weinberg. You're saying on Vegas, I know the Italians own Vegas, all the families out there. Crichton. The way it works is this. Everybody's got their sphere of authority, their joint, their split of the cut, including Atlantic City, okay? If every mob family had to watch every other family, it would be fucking warfare. Weinberg. Bloodshed. Crichton. Okay, because nobody would trust anybody. So early in the game,
It was decided that they had to have somebody that everybody had implicit trust in. That guy became Meyer. Absolute unequivocal law when it came to cutting up the pot, okay? If a dollar came in and he, Meyer, was entitled to $3, and you were entitled to $6, he got his $3, and you got your $6, and I got my $5. Whatever was the arrangement, there were no excuses. If you were to be delivered your $6 Thursday at noontime, you got your $6. Okay, that's the way it went for years, and that's the way it still goes. There was a dispute several times. A guy would say, I don't think I have the right count. The mob would have a meeting. The top guy would say, Meyer's word is law. We will hear from Meyer. He will give us an explanation, and that's it. Now, what did that accomplish? First, it put the whole fucking on a business-like basis. There was no killing there, no shootings there, no fighting, no arbitration, nothing. Now, they had to be able to trust this man Meyer implicitly, right? Because he had control over hundreds of millions of dollars. But he never fucked anyone. Weinberg, sighing inwardly, pressed for a meeting with Malnick. He hoped that Criden was exaggerating, but knew he wasn't. Criden's inside knowledge was too exact, and his track record so far had been 100%. Criden picked up the phone and dialed through to Malnick's penthouse. Arrangements were made with Malnick to meet for dinner at the Forge restaurant in Miami on Thursday night, September 20th. Criden said that Malnick owned it. As the meeting ended, Criden took Weinberg aside. The most important thing, he warned. We can't jerk Alvin off. Weinberg deadpanned his reply. We told him the way it is. Criden had still worried. It was obvious that the jowly lawyer was just as concerned as Weinberg about upsetting the mob, although for different reasons. He told Weinberg, We have the opportunity of a lifetime with this guy Malnick, okay? He can do things and open doors for us that you never dreamed existed. However, the minute our credibility is dead, we're dead. There goes that word again, thought Weinberg. A knock on the door brought Weinberg abruptly back to the present. He was in Florida to meet Malnick. He answered the knock. It was Diane. He forgot about the mob. That evening, as Weinberg and Diane walked through the lobby on the way out to dinner, they were greeted by Criden and the mayor, who insisted on taking them to a restaurant they had discovered. He sensed that the two had been waiting in ambush. He nodded to Diane and played along. Criden drove. They pulled into a restaurant parking lot and got out. This was where Lansky's stepson had been riddled with bullets, announced Criden. Weinberg winced. Inside, a table was already set for six. There were several platters of onion board, Weinberg's favorite. An attractive woman accompanied by a strange man sat down at the table with them. Criden introduced her. She was Susan, Meyer Lansky's stepdaughter-in-law, the mother of his four grandchildren. Weinberg watched carefully. He knew what was happening. Criden was proving his connections, and Weinberg was being measured. It was a careful conversation. The stranger with Susan said little. Weinberg has never identified him. Criden and the mayor burbled politely with Diane. Susan concentrated on Weinberg. She's the pump, he decided. She asked him about Europe and the places there he had been and seen. It was a subject he'd often mentioned to the mayor and Criden. Susan had traveled extensively. He passed her testing easily. He gently probed her family life. She was friendly, but vague. Suddenly it clicked. Susan was looking him over before Alvin Malnick decided whether to keep his dinner appointment the next night at the Forge. Weinberg ate and drank little. He said just enough to appear open and unconcerned. On the way back to the motel, Criden told him that everything was set for the next night with Malnick. Evidently he had gotten a good report card from Susan. There was another plus. His abscam partner, Tony Amoroso, would be at the Forge. He was flying in that night. Even so, dinner with Alvin Malnick was a letdown. He kept the subject general, discussing the cricket club, his efforts to get casino gambling in Florida, and the Aladdin. The meeting wasn't taped. Good had decided that body tapes in this league with these players would be too dangerous.
and people didn't bring attaché cases to dinner. Malnick invited them to his penthouse the next week. Afterward, he said, they would take a cruise on his boat. Malnick was cute, Weinberg told Good later that night. He didn't talk in front of witnesses. He would choose his own time and place to talk business, Weinberg predicted. It happened the next week. The following Saturday, accompanied by Amoroso and his own teenaged son, Weinberg visited Malnick at his penthouse. It was impressive. Malnick explained that each of the club's condominium units went for $350,000, but Malnick was putting in some improvements. He escorted them to the roof where he was installing his personal swimming pool and helicopter pad. Important for privacy, he explained. He introduced the group to a teenaged girl whom he identified as his daughter. There were several other guests. After a half-hour of chit-chat, Malnick invited everyone for a cruise. Malnick's yacht, berthed at a nearby marina, was a 100-footer with a uniformed crew. The guests boarded and the craft sailed out into Biscayne Bay. Scene. Malnick's cruiser cuts swirls of white foam as it purrs past Fisher Island and into the Atlantic. The guests sit with drinks in hand, making polite conversation. Weinberg's son is playing backgammon with Malnick's daughter. Weinberg's son is winning consistently. Weinberg watches fondly over his son's shoulder. His son wins again. Weinberg leans forward and whispers into his ear, "Lose, schmuck. Don't you want to marry into the family?" Halfway through the trip, Malnick made his move. He took Weinberg and Amoroso to a deserted part of the deck and laid it on the line. He could get them the Aladdin, he said. It would require an under-the-table payment of $10 million. To buy out the mob point holders from Detroit. The price on top of that, he said, would be $105 million. Part of it an assumed Teamster mortgage. He would arrange for the proper people to run the Aladdin for Abdul. Malnick said that he wanted to package the Aladdin sale with the cricket club. He said that he owned 25% of the club, and Sam Cohen owned the other 75%. Moreover, he admitted that he didn't like Cohen. In any event, Abdul could buy the cricket for $42 million. Or, Malnick said, Abdul could keep him as a partner in the cricket and pay only $30 million, maybe less, for Cohen's piece of the complex. He said that he would handle all of Abdul's casino problems in Atlantic City. He wanted Abdul immediately to put up $10 million in good faith money to be held in escrow for the Aladdin deal. Back at the hotel that night, Weinberg and Amoroso discussed Malnick's offer with Good. Malnick obviously wanted to unload the Aladdin. Nevada officials were probing the ownership of the huge hotel. Weinberg said that the mob apparently wanted to bail out while its points still had value. If Malnick, who was barred in Nevada from casino ownership, selected the Aladdin staff for Abdul, the mob would still have a voice in the casino with Abdul as a front. The cricket club, Weinberg had learned, was a loser. It had been open for 4 years, and only half of the units had been sold. Besides, argued Weinberg, there was the matter of Cliff Perlman's involvement in the cricket club loans. Nevada officials had told Perlman to end all ties with Malnick 2 years ago. If anyone learned of Perlman's continuing responsibility for the cricket loans, Caesar's licenses could be endangered both in Nevada and Atlantic City. If Abdul bought the club, Perlman was home free. Good was fascinated. On the surface, no crime was involved in the Malnick offer. But the Bureau was gaining valuable information on Lansky's casino interests. The information could be used later at licensing hearings in Nevada and New Jersey. There was only one problem, said Good. None of it was on tape. He told Weinberg to arrange a meeting with Malnick at some place where he could be taped. Weinberg howled. Malnick was super cautious, he said. He had only talked to them on his own boat while the engine roared. Get it on tape, Good repeated. Over the next month, Criden pressed for an answer to Malnick's offer, and Weinberg went into a quarter stall. Malnick had not been specific enough, Weinberg complained. Abdul's accountants wanted flow sheets on Aladdin profits. There had to be more discussion of the $10 million payoff to the Detroit mob. What kind of receipt could he show Abdul for that? Weinberg urged another meeting. Crichton was stubborn. Weinberg, learning that Malnick was due in New York that week, invited him through Crichton to Abdul's suite at the Plaza Hotel. Crichton was noncommittal. Arachetti, by this time, had gone into his permanent sulk and rarely answered when Weinberg called. One day, however, he came to the phone and accused Weinberg of stalling Malnick. Weinberg countered that Malnick might come to the plaza that week. The mayor disagreed. "I think he feels you're full of shit," said Arachetti. "And you know what? You'd better get the $10 million up before anything else happens. That's the word I'm getting." Weinberg put down the phone and scratched his head. Damn good in his tapes. He thought about it. Malnick had admitted a dislike for Sam Cohen. Weinberg recognized the dislike as the new guard, old guard syndrome. Quite simply, he figured that Malnick was jealous of Cohen's long ties of friendship with Lansky. Senator Williams' business partner George Katz was talking the same way in reverse. Katz, close to Cohen, kept insisting that Cohen was Lansky's top man, not Malnick. Weinberg decided to use the rivalry as a wedge to force another meeting with Malnick. First, though, he'd have to fan the fire a little. Weinberg called Katz and confided that Malnick hated Cohen. He said that Malnick wanted Cohen out of the cricket club because Cohen was too cheap to run a quality place. He related a story from Malnick that Cohen screamed at club waiters for putting more than 2 pats of butter on a plate. Katz.
Who, Sam does that?
Weinberg.
Yeah.
Katz.
I don't believe it.
Weinberg.
That's what he says.
Katz, later.
Meyer says he doesn't even know Malnick.
Weinberg.
I know he says it, but that's bullshit.
Katz.
Well, I'm not going to tell you any different.
Weinberg.
We were told this.
Katz.
Whoever told you is full of shit.
Weinberg.
He's not a partner?
Katz.
He's not supposed to talk about it, whether he is or isn't. Do you understand?
Weinberg cradled the phone, smiling. Katz would burn up the long-distance line to Florida telling Cohen about Malnick's insults. Now for his next call. This time it was to Howard Crichton. He told Crichton that someone very close to Lansky had told him that Sam Cohen dealt for Lansky, not Malnick. And he said his friend had told him that Cohen would sell the cricket to Abdul at a cheaper price. Crichton had been at meetings with Weinberg and Katz, so he knew who Weinberg's tipster was. Now it was his turn to be upset. Several days later, Crichton was back on the phone. Malnick had agreed to meet again. This time, Weinberg was taking no chances. He complained that Malnick's apartment and the Forge restaurant were too busy. Malnick was always either getting phone calls or greeting customers. They needed a quiet, private place. He suggested Crichton's condominium at the Hemisphere House in Hallandale. Crichton agreed. Weinberg hung up jubilant. He and Amoroso could bring the bugged attaché case to the apartment without appearing conspicuous. The meeting was set for the evening of October 27th. Meanwhile, there was another development. Malnick's bank had called Abdul's friend at Chase Manhattan. The message went back to Malnick that Abdul had an account in the millions. At this point in the investigation, Weinberg and Amoroso used the names of Abdul and Yasser interchangeably. Both were partners, they explained, operating as Abdul Enterprises Limited. It was a fuzzy story, but it avoided slip-ups. Weinberg and Amoroso arrived at Crichton's Ocean View condominium at the appointed time to find Crichton waiting with Malnick. Gingerly, Weinberg put the attaché case on the floor next to the coffee table. Malnick played the host. He poured coffee for everyone and began by asking Amoroso whether he wanted sugar or sweetened low. During the next hour, mob protocol was strictly observed. Never once did Malnick or the Abscam agents mention the name of Lansky. Malnick's presence as Lansky's man was accepted and understood. Atlantic City was not on that night's agenda. That would be discussed at a later date. Malnick stuck with his sales pitch for the Aladdin and the cricket club. But he gave a fascinating glimpse at the power of the mob in Las Vegas. In the process, he tied Caesar's palace to Lansky by implication. And he said enough to provide fireworks for casino licensing agencies in Nevada and New Jersey. The bottom line of Malnick's taped conversation was something that honest law enforcement agencies had known for years. There can be no successful casino gambling without the mob. It was evident in everything he said. Malnick started with a review of the cost figures for the Aladdin. Weinberg questioned how it would be possible to account to Yasser for the secret $10 million paid to the mob point holders from Detroit. Weinberg. Who'll be getting the $10 million cash? Malnick. There's no way I can tell you. Weinberg. How the hell are we going to explain that to Yasser? Somebody's going to have to accept it. Malnick. Someone will accept it, but no one is going to accept it and acknowledge it. Later. I mean, it's as sensitive as hell. Later. I think the somebody who's going to accept it is not an identifiable person to begin with, right? Let's assume that three people are receiving a portion of it. They're not in the deal. They don't appear anywhere. Malnick told Weinberg and Amoroso that the Aladdin was presently under option to Eddie Torres, former operator of the Riviera in Las Vegas, and his partner Del Coleman. How could Malnick keep Torres and Coleman from exercising their option? Weinberg asked. I can arrange it so that they can't, Malnick replied quietly. Malnick said that after Abdul bought the Aladdin, Torres would manage it. He would guarantee Torres. I'm not worried about his integrity, said Malnick, because he'll owe the integrity to me. He added, there will be nobody who will steal anything from you. Nobody's going to be taking scores out of that place. Nobody. You don't have to worry about anybody. The discussion turned to other costs once Abdul acquired the Aladdin. Malnick said that there would only be one, the political slush fund. He spoke about it carefully, almost hesitantly. In fact, he was discussing the mob's most poorly kept secret, a fund to fix Nevada politicians. Even so, Malnick played his cards closely. Malnick. Things, the slush fund. That are customary, that are done. There are certain obligations that are taken care of. None of it's mandatory, follow me? Crichton. Most of the casinos make certain contributions to a group, okay? Weinberg. Absolutely. Crichton. To various political guys in the state, okay? If you want to contribute, you get part of the benefit. The conversation drifted, but Weinberg nudged it back toward the slush fund. He was hoping to get names, but Malnick was too careful. Weinberg. Are they, officials, cracking down out there now? Malnick. Oh my God, it's so extensive, the investigation, you have absolutely no idea. Weinberg. Is there somebody you can reach out for? Malnick. Sure. Weinberg. Well, that could be our way, then. Malnick. There are a few things that we have going, but it's still a problem. You don't have everybody going in unison. You got a couple of politicians here, a couple there. I don't have to tell you what politicians are. Laughs. I'll take what you got as long as there's no heat. Once there's a little bit of heat, I don't like these guys anyway. Malnick conceded that the Aladdin's profits were in the doldrums. It was under state trusteeship. But he was enthusiastic about the casino's possibilities. He became expansive and revealed the continuing Lansky interest in Caesar's Palace. He gushed. What you have to do is what we did with Caesar's Palace. We never made any money because we always put it back into the joint. We always added 200 rooms here, 300 rooms there, till over at that joint we have 2,000 rooms now. Weinberg nodded in satisfaction. Gotcha, Caesar's. Malnick had used the word we 6 times in talking about Caesar's Palace. The same group owned the Boardwalk Regency in Atlantic City. So much, he thought, for political promises to keep casino gambling clean. Malnick talked on about his group's ability to make or break almost any casino through control of key employees. Just like poor credit, he said. We take a joint that's making $10 million a year. And turn it into a loser of $10 million a year. As Weinberg listened, he mentally renewed his determination never to buy gambling casino stocks. Betting football games with a bookie was safer. The subject moved to the cricket club in Miami. Malnick denied that it was going broke. He said that the club had just sold condominiums to the presidents of Mexico and Guatemala. He had, however, a more ambitious plan for Abdul and Yasser. He proposed buying the next-door Lear School and the jockey club next to the school. The two new packages, he said, could be joined to the cricket to create the biggest resort in Miami. Moreover, the entire package wouldn't cost more than $60 million if he were kept in as a 25% partner. If casino gambling were legalized in Florida, according to Malnick, the package would be worth more than $300 million. Weinberg and Amoroso showed enthusiasm. A total of $180 million for the Aladdin and the new cricket package was not difficult, they said, for their rich Arab employers. It sounded like a good deal. Weinberg, however, left open an escape hatch. It all depended, he said, on how the Arabs felt about paying the secret $10 million in cash to people who would never acknowledge the money. Malnick warned that the deal would have to move quickly. Other buyers, including entertainer Johnny Carson, were nibbling at the Aladdin. As Malnick lifted Cryden's phone to make a call, he smiled. I think this phone is a lot safer than mine. It had been a productive evening. Weinberg wanted to pump Malnick some more, but the tape in the attaché case was almost exhausted. Amoroso hurried to get out with the tape intact. Weinberg asked one last question of Cryden. If Abdul purchased the properties, who was going to pay Cryden his part in putting the deal together? Cryden replied, I'm not your responsibility. Let's put it this way. I'm Alvin Malnick's responsibility. On the drive back to the motel, Weinberg couldn't shake the memory of Cryden's final words. Cryden, through his nationwide net of fellow middlemen, seemed able almost at will to produce congressmen for bribes. He'd already brought in several of them and appeared ready to produce others. But Cryden was obviously Malnick's man, and Malnick was Lansky. He wondered how many congressmen Cryden produced for the mob. The old fear returned. He had scammed Lansky's protege. The tape would make life miserable for the gambling mob, at least for a little while. The politicians would come back with their hands out as soon as the heat was off and things would return to normal. The government would forget Mel Weinberg. But the mob wouldn't. He shuddered. It was a sultry night, but the breeze from the ocean felt cold. Atlantic City, New Jersey, Associated Press, November 11, 1980. Atlantic City's four legal casinos grossed $58.7 million, or an average of $1.9 million a day during October, pushing the boardwalk's total win close to $1 billion. Caesars Boardwalk Regency won $18.3 million, or an average of $591,851 a day during October. This is 10% more than the September gross and 23% more than the October 1979 take. Tape 16. Weinberg. Malnick is very sharp. That's his rep every place. He said too much to us that night, but almost anybody else would have said more. Sure, I worry about it. I ain't going into no witness protection program. That's like being in a prison without no doors. I've seen other guys from my walk of life, let's say. They bust their humps working and testifying for the government. They set themselves up to be dead men. 5 years later, nobody gives a shit about them. They're, like, embarrassing to everybody. They're blown. They can't help anybody's careers no more. That's why so many of these government jokers like the protection program. They can send you someplace in the fucking Utah desert and change your name and never have to see you or think of you again. Screw them. If John gets me a big bonus at the end of this and the book makes money, I'll support my family and protect myself. If not, I'll haunt their asses. 12. Takeouts and takedowns.
I'm a swindler. There's only one difference between me and the congressman I met on this case. The public pays them a salary for stealing. Mel Weinberg. Weinberg was exhausted. He slouched, eyes at half-mast, in an easy chair in the study of the Washington townhouse. A vagrant thought wormed into his consciousness. He had forgotten to take his blood pressure pills. He was too tired to reach down for them and too afraid of dying not to. Every time he straightened up from putting on his socks, a blizzard of tiny white lights would shimmer in front of his eyes. A warning signal, the doctor had said. Slow down. Take it easy. Strokes kill. The same tired shit. He stirred for the first time in the last hour. Heaving a deep sigh, he reached down to his pocket for the brown plastic pillbox. Screw strokes, too, he thought. He washed the pills down with a swig of diet soda. Can in hand, he sat thinking, vaguely aware of sounds from other parts of the house. Laughter filtered down the stairway from the second floor. Good had just come in from Long Island. He was probably crowing because he had grabbed the only other bedroom with its own bathroom. Weinberg had the first one. The next agents in would get the two bedrooms without baths. Laggards got the bed in the basement control room or the couch. A rustle of noise in the kitchen. Weinberg catalogued it. Agent Ernie Haridopoulos making a sandwich. Ernie was always eating. All the FBI agents were ape for sandwiches, he grimaced. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner, sandwiches. He pictured the FBI Academy. A course on sandwich making, tucked in between Machine Gun Shooting 203, and Creative Ways to Screw Informants Out of Their Expenses 607. He was sick of sandwiches. A bureau electronics specialist walked softly into the semi-darkened room. He snapped on a light near the TV and popped a fresh roll of videotape into the hidden camera. The light clicked out, and the agent strode from the room. Weinberg eyed the silent TV screen. The agent, he knew, was setting up for tomorrow.